The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 107. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I've really looked forward to getting on. She is an oil expert, and she runs the investment division for a family office up in Montreal, and she is a FinTwit rock star, to say the least. Her name is Tracy Schuchart, and she is right here today. She's going to give us all the lowdown on the oil business, on commodities, on gold, everything you want to know. So Tracy, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. Now, Tracy and I are having technical issues. I'm in the Virgin Islands. As many of you know, the internet's down on this part of the islands. We're having to do everything through my cell phone. So we're going to try to make this work. And it's all about the content, right, Tracy?
Right.
All right. So the first thing I want to ask you, I just heard you on a podcast with our good buddy, Mr. Tesla Charts. And you guys were talking about where you see the price of oil going. He was talking how he sees it even going to $200 a barrel within the next year or two. I don't know if you were that optimistic or pessimistic, depending on what side of the coin you're on. But you did see a supply-demand imbalance that could possibly lead prices a lot higher. Could you explain that imbalance that you saw back a couple months ago and then how you see it today?
Obviously, right now we have the opposite of at supply imbalance, but I guess I should start back in starting last year. Started noticing, you know, we've had a lot of problems with the shale industry, and there's been a lot of bankruptcies, poor management, too many people threw money at them. You know, after when shale first started in 2008, and then after the crash in 2016, they got a bunch of, you know, VC guys and private equity guys throwing money at them. Nothing really improved. And really, you know, their business model still hasn't changed since, you know, the crash of this year. So I foresaw already, and I did something with Danielle on Real Vision about this, but we already foresaw problems in the industry and that, you know, there were going to be a lot of mergers and acquisitions, a lot of bankruptcies. There were already starting to be a lot of CapEx cuts and things of that nature. So we already saw
prior to COVID.
This is prior, right? Exactly. So I already knew kind of that I was already kind of looking at it from a short perspective before COVID came along, and was looking at, you know, out in the horizon, you know, what was going to happen with these companies. And I already foresaw that there was going to be a problem. Then compounded, we had COVID, right? So we had a huge demand loss, too much supply. And then on top of that, then we had the OPEC meeting, and we had Russia back out. So we just had three things really compound, which led to the negative pricing in what happened in April. But moving forward, looking out, and because of all of this globally now, we have a CapEx problem, not only from all of the majors, you know, but all of the smaller emerging markets and things like that were really hurt. So all of these companies, now we have a global CapEx problem looking out into the future. So I foresee that as soon as things get back to normal, whatever normal is, but, you know, I mean, demand will come back, and it is slowly coming back. We're going to have a deficit as far as supply is concerned out in 2021, 22. And so that's where I can kind of see that inflationary price spike.
So just to summarize, initially you were looking at this from the demand side of the equation, and on the supply side, you're noticing that they're spending a lot less on CapEx, on growing their reserves. And then we had COVID, so we have this massive demand crash. But then at the same time, now we have a supply crash that might be crashing even faster than the demand side of the equation, which still could lead to higher prices. And then if we have the demand pick back up to anywhere close to where it was before, we could really see some high prices because of that imbalance. I would argue that we might not even see that much demand destruction because of everything the government is doing now with the stimulus checks and potentially helicopter money, MMT, UBI. It's people look at the job side and say, well, there's going to be a lot less demand because unemployment's 20%, but they're associating a job with income. But right now, a lot of people have an income without having a job. Right now, the two and two don't necessarily go hand in hand. So, okay, we see, I'm assuming you're kind of bullish on the price of oil. We're at 40 now for the next, call it 6 months or year. Where would you be maybe 5 years to 10 years? I talked to Art Berman about this, and this is more of a structural issue with oil itself. What's your opinion on the long-term horizon?
Long-term horizon, I think that, oil is going to go down again because I just think that there's the big renewable push. There's, electric vehicles. There's things like that. The price spike I foresee within the next 1 to 2 year horizon is definitely not going to be sustainable because at that point, that will even hasten the overturn to renewables and electric vehicles and things like that if oil prices are that high, right? So I kind of see it as a bell curve right now, right? Where we're kind of down here, we'll probably hit a high, and then, over the next 5 to 10 years, we'll probably see, sustainably lower oil prices as we kind of make a change over, because we have a lot of countries that are, have very aggressive goals. So it always takes longer than what they really think that it's going to take. But, you have Germany, Japan, China all have these goals anywhere between, 2035 and 2050.
You look at the geopolitical side of the equation quite a bit. You study that. How does that play out with these developed worlds trying to make a push toward renewable energy if we go into a recession/depression? For the next 2 years, let's say, because of this crisis we're dealing with, does that push towards green energy and renewables kind of get shelved for a while because we've got bigger fish to fry? Or do you think there's still going to be that hard push?
As far as emerging markets are concerned, no, because they just won't have the funds to be able to do that, right? They're already having problems right now. If you look at emerging markets that are oil producers, they have all this debt that they acquired when it was cheap, all this U.S. denominated debt. Right. And with oil prices, even at $40, they're not making any money, right? Mm-hmm. So that's already an issue for them. So if we go into sort of a depression, you're going to need a lot of IMF money.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. But yeah, that would definitely, for those smaller countries and things like that, those plans would definitely get shelved some. When you're talking about bigger markets like, Japan or China or Germany, I think that it's so ingrained within their new infrastructure plans that, mm-hmm. They'll go forward with it, especially in Europe. All of their stimulus money and everything is based on like renewable.
Yeah, got it. And I also think that taxes, if we do go into a recession, depression, whatever it may be in the developed world, are going to be going up substantially, especially in the United States. And I think that's one thing that they're going to be taxing right off the bat is going to be property taxes and then maybe higher gas taxes.
And, for sure.
Just trying to, pick people's pockets that way. So if you see oil going up substantially in, we'll call it the midterm, what do you see going on with the dollar?
It depends on the time horizon we're talking.
Yeah. And also, let me clarify, Tracy, when I talk about the dollar, I'm talking about the dollar and the DXY, because it can be dollar against the stocks, against
money. Right.
It can be dollar against consumer goods in the United States. Right. You got to compartmentalize. So I'm just talking about the DXY.
I think that everybody's declared the dollar is dead because the Fed is printing and we have all these swap lines and things of that nature. I still am bullish. I think we have one last kind of spike higher. So what's before it's the end all be all, and you know, we're done with it all, or because everybody's already decided it's done with. But what I would be watching are like swap lines and things like that, because I think that when push comes to shove, I think that, you know, because the Treasury is in charge of swap lines, not really the Fed. At any time, the government can use that sort of as a weapon. So I wouldn't put that past anything at this point, especially as we near this election. I think it's going to be a very contentious time, and the administration wants a stronger dollar. So I think we could see some of those swap lines kind of being used as leverage against other countries, even after the election, as a means to coerce them to sort of do what we want, do what the United States wants.
Is your view that the U.S. or the administration wants a stronger dollar because they want more leverage over those countries with dollar-denominated debt?
I believe so at this point, yes. I mean, because of a lot of the geopolitical issues that are going on right now, like Nord Stream 2 in Germany, you know, that's the Russian gas pipeline that the administration...
So what's happening with that, Tracy? So I haven't heard anything about that.
It's a Russian gas pipeline, okay. Nord Stream 2, and basically... We've had sanctions on Russian gas and oil for a very long time, but the government, the U.S. government, does not want this pipeline to be built. And Germany's going ahead with it, and we've already sanctioned part of it to make it less easy, I guess, to be able to build. But Russia's kind of already said, we're going to build it anyway. Germany said, we're going to have them build it anyway. And it's kind of a very contentious spot right now over this pipeline. So in that respect, you know, we could, you know, pull swap lines from the ECB or, you know, any way you could use as political leverage, you know, if you don't want, you know, if you don't want Germany and or the EU getting close to China or Moscow.
Yeah. So, yeah. And if the dollar goes down, then they're not going to have that leverage because that eases the pressure on the dollar-denominated debt.
Right.
What do you think is the top-line threshold for the dollar, though? Because at a certain point, it becomes detrimental for all parties involved, including the United States. So if it goes up to 120, I mean, Brent Johnson has talked about it going up to 140, and they have to come in with like a Plaza Accord 2.0.
I think we did actually hit 103, which, you know, I had been talking about forever, but I could see another spike. You know, I'm not sure that 140, perhaps 140, but 110 was kind of where I saw the next possibility. And yes, that would put massive pressure on everyone and the system. Absolutely.
Yeah. How do you think they alleviate that? I see two ways. I see kind of a Plaza Accord 2.0, but I guess even if they had that Plaza Accord 2.0, the transfer mechanism for the dollar would still be the New York Fed going in and printing up bank reserves, going into the FX markets to buy other currencies with dollars to get right. the value down. Is that how you see them kind of finessing it, for lack of a better word?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what they would have to do, right? If you want to comment, you have to basically, you know, open swap lines, or they could come up with something entirely, you know, new and creative. Who knows? They're good at that.
Yeah. Creative. I like the creative word when we're talking about the Fed. It's so true. If we would have thought back just 6 months before now, I mean, who would have guessed we would be where we are today, not only with this crazy virus and everything that's going on with that, but also with the Fed and you've been talking about the swap lines. We have all these 4 and 5 letter programs that we had back in 2008, but now they're on steroids. We're doing $1 trillion a day commitment in the repo market, QE infinity, the balance sheet's at $7 trillion. We've got $6 trillion in stimulus or $3 trillion, whatever it is. We've got all these checks going out. People are cashing them, setting up a Robinhood account and buying bankrupt companies, right?
Right.
Who would have thought? If I would have said, this is what's going to happen in 6 months, you would have said that I was absolutely crazy. But that's what 2020's been. And to your point, I think it's going to get even crazier going into the election. Do you have a view on the TGA? Luke Grohman's been talking about that a lot. I've been trying to think that through. You know, the Treasury has $1.7 trillion basically at their disposal right now that they could spend into the economy, which would increase M2 directly. That increases bank reserves. It's basically like doing a trillion plus of quantitative easing in a month. I mean, I don't know how fast they could inject it into the economy. So how do you see that factoring into the mix? I mean, could that take the Dow to 35,000 to 40,000 while unemployment's at 20 or 25%?
As ridiculous as it sounds, highly likely.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So you see the administration potentially using that. And I don't want to single out the Trump administration.
I'm not singling out. I would say that about anybody that was currently in office, that they would be able to use that as a tool to wield in an effort to kind of push people to do what you want them to do. Right.
Buy
it's
votes.
It's a tool.
Call a spade. They're going to buy votes. I mean, let's just, left or right, they all do it. Okay. One thing I wanted to touch on, because I have a lot of viewers and listeners who are kind of getting into the game as far as investing, and they're worried about inflation, they're worried about deflation. They understand that all this money printing probably won't end well, but they're just trying to preserve their purchasing power, or they're trying to invest in the future. Then I have other people who are far more advanced. But one mistake that I see people make, and I think it's a mistake, maybe I'm wrong, is they really look at, they do 99.9% of their analysis on whether or not they think XYZ asset or stock is going up. And then they don't even think about portfolio construction. They don't think about when they're going to sell. They don't think about money management. So as someone that does this for a living, I've been asking a lot of people this lately, how do you go about that? So let's say you think oil is going up over the next 2 years. I mean, do you allocate 2% of your portfolio to that? Do you allocate 20%? And then how do you manage the risk? And then how do you know at where's your entry point to buy? But maybe even more importantly, when do you sell? I mean, say it goes to 100 to 150. Do you buy? Do you hold? I mean, what on earth do you do? I think that, well, I almost know that the average Joe and Jane out there, they never think about that. So it's like a dog chasing a car, where even if the dog catches the car, they don't know what to do with it. So say your gold goes up to 10,000 an ounce. Okay, great. Now what do you do?
Most of my portfolio, the one that, you know, that I run is energy portfolio. So that's basically what, you know, I'm running energy and gold. That's because I'm just running a piece of it. So everything's allocated to that. I mean, it kind of was, you know, we had the oil crash, we had COVID. So, you know, it was sort of easy to go in and, you know, buy a bunch of high beta, 90% off stocks, right? That I'll probably sit on. It really depends on what your time horizon is. Well, my time horizon is, you know, 1 to 2 years, because then I think that the oil industry is going to take another turn for not the best.
Okay.
So that's just kind of what my personal time horizon is. But I mean, you know, you have to kind of cut what's not working quickly. I mean, that sounds easier than it really is. But, you know, just cut your losses early is really the best way that I can go to describe that.
Yeah, but how do you determine if it's not working or if you should buy more?
I don't know. This is a tough question. People always ask me that. I don't even know.
It is because very few people think about it. You know, they go in and they buy, let's say, oil, or they buy Shell at $25 a barrel. And if it doesn't go up, I mean, if it goes down to 15, do you buy more or do you cut your losses? It all goes back to that money management that I think most people completely ignore.
Right. I mean, I wouldn't let something go $10 against me. That's what
do you put a stop loss on?
Yeah, I put a stop loss, because you can always re-enter. If it goes lower and you still want that stock, you can always re-enter lower instead of averaging down, you know. And I know a lot of people that average in, and that's fine too. I just would rather have a stop loss, and then you can always, you know, buy it lower.
Do you raise that stop loss as the price goes up?
Yes.
So you've got a macro view, you've got an entry point, then you kind of trend follow it up. until it gets to a certain point where you feel as though it's just not, it's past its time horizon.
Stopped out, right.
Or it stopped out. Yeah, yeah. Okay. So as far as the geopolitical horizon right now, what do you see? I mean, what's really interesting you? What are you thinking about? And then how are you viewing that through the lens of your oil, commodities, energy, and gold portfolio?
Well, really what I'm looking at is supply chains moving. The supply chains are going to be moving out of China. It just is what it is, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, we're looking at what countries would be the beneficiary for the United States, for example, which we would have Thailand, Vietnam, you're going to have Latin America, you're going to have South America, you're going to have Mexico, you'll have, you know, somewhat Canada. Really, that's kind of what I'm focused on. So if you're, say, you're investing in, say, automobiles or, you know, things of that nature, those kind of supply chain shifts will matter to how fast everything is manufactured, gets to the floor, gets to the customer and whatnot. So that's one thing that I'm definitely watching. Also, you know, watch as far as the oil industry is concerned, really, there's a growing unrest in the Middle East. I mean, there's always unrest in the Middle East. But right now, particularly Libya is a very big hot spot. It's been for years because they've had a civil war. But right now, Europe's getting dragged into it. Egypt's getting dragged into it. It's dragging Greece, Cyprus, and all of those have different levels of, you know, there's oil and gas all involved in that area. And it's getting to be really tense. So that's something that I'm particularly focused on.
From a supply shock standpoint.
Right. So that's an area I'm watching on. You also should be focusing on like BRI, especially if you're investing in metals, because China's in Africa, all over Africa, you know, subsidizing things and whatnot. So that will make a difference into, you know, the mining industry there. If there's an influx of cash, there's sort of a growing concern that China's a little too involved, right? And so you're going to kind of see shifts away from that. So what will that do to the mining industry and things of that nature? So those are just kind of the things, obviously, besides COVID and the other things that are going on.
Yeah, I think there was a move towards deglobalization prior, and everything that's gone on with the virus has just accelerated it just so quickly. But it's definitely comes and goes in cycles. And that goes back to your point of inflation and with the price of oil. But that's interesting because the dollar, what's your time horizon on the dollar? Because if oil is going up over the next 2 years, it's going to be, isn't that going to be tough for the dollar to go up as well if we've got these global supply chains being disrupted and everything now being manufactured potentially in countries where the wages are much higher? Therefore, every kind of notch in the supply chain has a higher cost of input cost?
Yes, but I am of the opinion that like gold and the dollar can go up together, which we did see about a year, right? In 2018 to, you know, 2019, basically they went up together. You know, oil was going up at the same time too. So I don't think that that correlation, everybody considers the dollar correlation is a, you know, one, it's always an inverse correlation to commodities,
right?
But that's not really always the case. You know, there's a lot of other things that play a role in that. So I kind of try to tell people to steer clear about with that type of thinking where it's a one-to-one inverse correlation, because it's really, really not that correlation goes in and out. You know, if you look at oil, for example, you know, I would look at Norwegian krona or, you know, the CAD, Canadian dollar. Even for gold, that's a better correlation. There's just some other currencies that I feel are more correlated to commodities than necessarily the dollar, which the dollar does have an impact. I just think it's just not how people perceive it to be.
Yeah. Can you walk us through that deep dive of shale that you did with Danielle? Because I think that is something that people really need to understand to figure out for themselves what the supply-demand balance or imbalance may be over the next year, especially if prices don't go above 40 or 50, because to my understanding, shale needs it at maybe 60, 70 to be profitable. So can you kind of help us understand from the start all this cheap? I mean, the Fed drops interest rates artificially low. Everyone goes out the risk curve. So they try to find some yield in this new, let's call it emerging type of technology, although it's been there for a long time, called shale. So it's like the gold rush, all this money comes in, but we find out that it's not that profitable. Now all of a sudden, oil's at 40 and they need $70 to get it out of the ground. And then you have this massive supply destruction. And then does that prevent capital in the future from moving into that space again? Or do interest rates go so far negative, they dump more money into it?
You have to look at it. But first, all the banks got burned, right? After the 2014-16 crash. And they were like, okay, we don't want to lend you any more money, even with artificially lower interest rates. And then, the private equity guys came in and were like, yeah, we've got all this money to spend. We have nowhere to spend it, right? Let's throw it at shale. And then we just had the oil crash. So, as far as shale's concerned, I mean, they're kind of running out of pools of money to lure people.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Have the pension funds gone into shale? Did they take that bait or not?
A lot of pension funds did, but I think they've sort of backed out of that. And especially with the new, green movements going on.
Right.
There are a lot of pension funds that even Norway, which is a big oil producing country, they are divesting from the oil industry for their pension. So a lot of the pension funds are actually backing out of the oil industry entirely because of the green movement that's going on right now.
All right. So we have the pensions kind of backing out. You don't think there's going to be a strong appetite to go back into the shale market if a lot of these guys go bust, regardless of what happens with the price. So that's going to be a supply constriction for a long time.
Yeah.
It just makes me kind of wonder where the next malinvestment is going to be, because we've got all this the tops down type of micromanagement of the economy and the demand side, especially. And whenever that happens, as you know, you get massive malinvestment, unintended consequences.
Oh, sure.
And so I'm just trying to say, okay, it was shale. Now, is it just everything other than shale? I mean, is it the airlines? pick, right?
There's a lot of things out there. I think it, I don't know. You have got Tesla, right?
Yeah.
So there's a bunch of new EV car companies coming up. So.
Oh, Nikola.
Nikola, Neo.
Truck companies. Yeah.
Yeah. So, perhaps that industry, especially, looking at Tesla, I know there's all problems with Tesla, but looking at their stock price, you have to think all these guys with all this money to spend, they're like, hey,
Did you see Jim Bianco's tweet the other day when Tesla was just up a ton and then down a ton? He said in the morning, and I'm probably saying this wrong, but something to the effect that in the morning, Tesla went up by the entire market cap of GM and then went down at the end of the day by the entire market cap of a BMW. So it gained a GM and lost a BMW in one day. I mean, Wow, that doesn't usually happen at the start.
I mean, but that's the smart. This is how nuts it's getting. When the JPM came out, they lost a ton of money on Hertz, you know, trading Hertz, because nobody knew that they were going to go bankrupt and everybody was going to buy it. Right.
Yeah,
so
right.
I guess they just came out. And they said they lost like 170 million on it or something like that.
Oh, geez. I didn't see that. Okay. So I'm guessing you're bullish gold. Does that include silver? Do you see them as two separate asset classes?
I don't trade silver. Okay. But I actually think that silver is a little bit undervalued because it's a precious metal, but it's also a utility metal. I mean, gold is too, in a sense. I'm surprised that it's not trading higher than it is, to be honest. Platinum's sort of the same way. It's a precious metal, but it's a utility metal too. They use it in a lot of automobile manufacturing.
And where is that trading, Tracy?
So right now it's about 860.
So is that cheap, is it, relatively speaking, like historically?
I mean, I think it can go a lot higher. It's up actually a lot for platinum, but I definitely think that it can go higher. I'm looking for like 1200 of platinum.
Okay. And what are your views on Bitcoin?
So I actually don't know a lot. I'm the worst person ever. I know. I don't know a lot about Bitcoin. I need to get on Real Vision and watch all those videos and get on my learning curve.
I probably should have done this at the beginning of the interview, but can you just give us a little bit of your backstory? I know you started off in the entertainment business in LA. You went out to USC, and then you said, well, I'm not really too fond of that. I think you got a sales gig in medical sales, and you went the polar opposite, went back to Chicago, and then were you on the floor? Or no, you got a broker gig.
I got a broker gig. Yeah.
Yeah, you're on the floor there. When you were in that environment, in Chicago, what were your greatest takeaways? Like, what did you learn the most from any mentor you had regarding not just trading, but investing, and more so the mentality? And what I'm thinking about are the Market Wizards books. I don't know if you read those, but you know, so many of those guys were like right on the floor and they learned so much. And a lot of them had a background in blackjack, and they use that type of strategy and that management to make a lot of money in the commodity space or even in trend following and the algorithm type of things that we have today. I'm just thinking about Ed Thorpe and James Simon specifically. But what types of those things did you learn?
Chicago board is crazy. So everything there is, you know, it's very fast. And I mean, I guess the best thing that I learned there was, you know, just money management, because working on the floor, we were an institutional broker. So we executed trades for the bigger hedge funds when they actually use the floor. But, you know, I mean, there's so much money going in and out daily, and things could turn on you in a second. So, you know, really just a lot of money management and things like that, working in a very fast-paced environment, which is why, you know, probably why I like trading something like oil, is because it's something that moves very quickly.
Yeah. How detrimental do you think it would be to your P&L if you tried to mix your current strategy, or the one that you feel most comfortable with a completely different type of strategy? As an example, you said that you are someone that likes a 1, maybe 2 year time horizon. What if you tried to all of a sudden think about things from like a 10-year time horizon? Do you think that would be detrimental? Do you think there might be some upside because it would be easier, or is it just not your personality, therefore you'd struggle with it? What do you think?
I think that time horizon for me would be a little bit too long. I would welcome learning sort of that strategy. Obviously, learning anything it's great. But, you know, just for my type of personality, I think that would be a little bit too long.
Yeah. And see, that's the question, or that's the answer I was trying to get at, because I'm really trying to encourage people to not only think about what is cheap and think about how they want to invest in the future, but I'm also trying to get people to think about their own personality and what's the best type of strategy for them? Are they someone that's going to sit and stay up all night and worry if they've got too much of their portfolio? Or are they someone that just has a massive appetite for risk to where they just don't care about it? You know, what's their monthly income? Can they afford to lose a little? Can they afford a lot of volatility? Maybe they can't. And I'm just trying to really get people to consider things that they might not have considered before, which I think plays maybe even a bigger role in being successful long-term than the stuff that people get hyper-focused on, which is, do I think it's going up or down in price?
Exactly. And, you know, it's different for everybody. I mean, I know, you know, obviously I know people that hold something for a day and that's too much, too long for them. And then, you know, I know people that trade 1 to 2 year, five to 10 year, you know, it really depends on how you're looking at it. Obviously, if you're looking at something like your 401k or something like that, you're looking at even a longer term horizon. But, you know, so it really depends on what is your portfolio allocated for. Is it your income? Is it your 401k? Is, you know, I think that just really depends. And then it depends on your type of personality. If you're running your own portfolio, you know, that you're kind of making a living on, kind of what your personal style is. Because like I said, some people get uncomfortable holding something for a week. A week would be nothing to me.
Yeah. What books did you read or have you read or are you reading now that really helped you solidify your framework and become successful?
I read all the Market Wizards books, obviously, because those are really good. Currently, I'm not reading anything. I probably should be. I can't think off of the top of my head.
Do you do a lot of technical?
So I start with my kind of way of looking at it is I approach it from fundamental aspect, right?
Okay.
So everything I address is by, you know, fundamentally, and then I drill it down to like a technical entry, right?
I see. So that's when you're kind of determining when you should buy is based on the charts.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. But you're not making your overall decision on what to look at through the charts. That's more of just the macro view first and then going down from there.
Right. Exactly. I do a lot of technical analysis as far as, you know, where do I want to enter? Where do I think I want to exit? And things of that nature. Sometimes you can go through charts and just say, wow, that looks bullish. I like that.
Okay. Then on Twitter, I know you're very active there. You've got probably, what, maybe 100,000 followers on Twitter now. Like I said, you're a rock star on Twitter for sure.
Something like that.
And I'm sure your feed is, you just get bombarded with people asking you questions and people, trolls and everything that we deal with on Twitter.
Yes.
But what do you think is the biggest mistake that you see the average Joe or Jane making? And every time you see that tweet, you're just like, ah, why are people doing this? I keep telling them not to do this. What I talked about, just getting fixated on price only and then just getting fixated on going up or down. What do you see people doing that if you could just kind of, if it was just a light switch that you could turn off really quick and you'd make everyone a 10 times better investor or trader, what would that be?
Stop saying everything's bullish. Every time you tweet something, everyone's like, it's bullish. Don't fight the Fed. It's bullish. Don't fight the Fed. Right. And then the market drops 500 points, right? So I don't know. A lot of people, like, they're not looking at the charts. Like, they're trying to fight the chart, right? Or trying to fight the fundamentals. Like, I think oil should be going down. Okay. But why? So I get a lot of, obviously, oil conversations. So, you know, sell it. And I'm like, what's your reason for selling it right here? Like, you know, let's talk about, like, nobody has a reason, just it shouldn't be there. So I think it's just, you know, having an idea fixated in your head, what you think should happen is not always what's going to happen. You kind of have to do a little research and kind of look at, if you're a technical trader, look at the chart a little, or at least have a fundamental reason. You know, people get stuck, you know, this should be going down or this should be going up. And it's not.
It's like they pick a narrative and they try to find just the information to validate their narrative, and everything else they just completely exclude it from the equation. I sent out a tweet the other day, and it was just something I was trying to think through. And I thought, everything, especially in the United States, has been so politicized. I mean, it's like, oh, you like ketchup? Oh, you must be a Republican. Therefore, right. You're XYZ. Or, oh, you like mustard? You must be one of those crazy liberals or something. I mean, it's okay. Down to that level of insanity.
It is.
So what if, and this is just a hypothesis, everything's been politicized to the point where now stocks are politicized, or your own investment portfolios. So you let's, and this is not me talking, this is the average person. The Fed has our back. We know all we have to do is buy the dip, and we're always going to get rich. It's just like Davy Day Trader says, all you have to do is just blindfold yourself, pick three letters, that's a ticker, you're going to make money. It's just a matter of how much money you make. So if I can't lose money in the stock market because the Fed has my back and all these other reasons, well, then why wouldn't I just buy something based on what makes me feel good as opposed to the fundamentals?
Right.
It sounds crazy to say that out loud, but do you think there's anything to that?
Sure. Why not? I mean, people are picking letters out of a Scrabble bag at this point. Come on. Sure. Right, if something makes you feel good, you like it. I don't know. At least, you know, I could justify that more if you were like, I really like this product. I love this product. I use it every day. I'm going to go ahead and buy the stock. I almost think that's a better way of choosing something than picking it out of a Scrabble bag or something like that.
Or because it fits a specific belief system that all my friends have. And then, you know, the echo chamber that I'm in on social media, whatever that may be, this just really fits along with everything that's in that echo chamber, whether it's on the left or right. There's both sides there.
Oh, it's the word.
It's just insanity. There's just such a disconnect between the stock market and the economy. I was just in Fort Lauderdale as an example. I had a humanitarian flight out of Columbia to Fort Lauderdale. Now I'm on my way to St. Bart's. But when I was in Fort Lauderdale, it was like a sci-fi movie. It was bizarre. I mean, not every store, but a lot of the stores were kind of closed and kind of quasi open, and people weren't really walking around too much on the weekends, and all the high-rise apartment buildings seemed to be kind of vacant, and I was like the only person in the hotel. And you're just thinking to yourself, okay, their margins are not 100%. Like we're talking about businesses that have like a 10%, if not lower, margin.
Oh, absolutely.
They got to be 96% full just to pay the bills. And they're not even close to that. But yet, and that's en masse. It's not just one or two businesses on the corner. I mean, that's like 50% of the businesses that you see.
Oh,
but yet
absolutely.
We've got stocks going up and up and up and up every single day. And then the only conclusion you can come to is just pure liquidity. And the fundamentals are just a moot issue at this point.
Well, they are. I mean, I think that's some of the frustration that everybody's having with the market right now, right? Because you see, I mean, the economy is, I think I saw this picture somebody did with like, there was like a mansion next to a pile of, you know, lumber that was like the economy, the stock market.
Yeah, exactly. So,
and that's really what it is. And I think a lot of people are having, perhaps not the Davy Day Trader type, those people, but I think like investors that, you know, have been investing for a while and things of that nature, you know, the disconnect is so wide. It's just kind of hard to wrap your mind around, right? Because unemployment's not getting any better. Restaurants, you know, look at the service industry. I mean, there's going to be so many businesses that are shutting. Look at the airline industry. They're already between all of them, I think there's over 100,000 layoffs globally. I mean, and these are jobs that are likely never coming back. I mean, especially these smaller restaurants and things like that. So I think that's just really something that's really hard for everybody right now to really wrap their head around as stocks are skyrocketing, which is kind of, you know, what I call causing a bigger great divide, right? And that's why I think we're seeing a lot of this social unrest, right? We're so used to seeing that kind of movement in the Middle East and things of that nature when we saw Arab Spring and things like that. Yeah. Now it's coming to the United States, right? Now we're having internal social unrest. because of the divide. It's getting too wide.
And you think about the only tools the Fed has at their disposal to fight a quote unquote downturn, or if the market goes down, is just going to exacerbate that problem. It just goes right back to artificially low interest rates, quantitative easing. It just makes the divide get bigger and bigger and bigger.
So exactly.
Where does that end?
To fix the credit markets, and that's what they wanted to do, right? They wanted to stop the bleeding in the credit markets, but that doesn't help average Joe, you know, who owns a restaurant and is trying to, you know, make a living.
That doesn't help them. Yeah. And unfortunately, I just did a video on this. This was based on a podcast with my good buddies, Jeff Snyder and Emil Kalinowski. They were talking about how Marxists actually view capitalism. And most people, I don't think, really understand. They just think that the immediate rebuttal to anyone who favors Marxism is just, oh, we'll look at China, or, oh, we'll look at Russia. And really, that's not too much of a rebuttal, because the Marxists get that, and that plays into their theory, because Marx viewed capitalism as something that was a necessary tool. It wasn't really an evil thing. It was just a necessary tool. He gave a lot of credit to capitalists and said, if you're starting off in feudalism, then you need capitalism to grow the society and to increase productivity and to create all the wealth that's required. But at a certain point, capitalism can't drive the economy any further, and it starts to feed upon itself. And that's when the communists need to come in and extract the wealth and the means of production from the capitalists. And so my point is that everything that we're seeing right now that's playing out in the economy, and this wealth divide and corporatism, the Marxist, I see that as too little capitalism. But they see that as a sign that capitalism has gone too far. And if we don't come in and have a Marxist revolution, then capitalism in and of itself is going to make things worse and worse and worse and worse until it just destroys society at large. So we need to take over using violence or whatever means possible. And again, going back to our original point, I think the Fed is just going to inadvertently exacerbate that, and it's going to fall right into their narrative. And unfortunately, I think things get a lot worse before they get better.
Yeah, unfortunately, I have to agree with you. I mean, I think it's just starting. Like, we're just seeing the seeds of this starting to sprout, I think, within the country, if something doesn't drastically change.
Yeah. How are you seeing that up in Canada? I don't know how much time you spend up there compared to, I don't know if you go back and forth between there in Chicago, or what are you seeing, a similar type of vibe, or is it a lot better there?
They always say Canadians are too nice. They're very nice. It's very much more laid back here. You know, obviously we're having economic issues as well, as everybody is. But from what I gather, I mean, the borders are closed, so I can't go back to the States. I haven't been able to go. From what I gather from talking to other people, it's not like, I mean, it's pretty normal here. I mean, there's social distancing, but everything's open. People are walking around. We don't really have riots. I think during that very first week when they were having riots, there was like one day here in the city, and that was, you know, that got kind of out of hand. But other than that, I mean, it's very, very different kind of vibe here.
Yeah. All right, Tracy. Well, I know we're running short on time here. We've gone almost an hour. That was a really, really cool conversation. I apologize for my cell phone and kind of being a little amateurish here, but it's all about the content, and people are going to love all the value that you delivered. So for any of my viewers or listeners that want to find out more about you, where can they go?
I'm on Twitter at ShyGirl, ChiGrl.
All right, Tracy, I appreciate it, and I cannot wait to do it again.
All right, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.